Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations, 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's report on being left behind, the rapture story, right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed this scriptural principle when they put into our federal constitution, Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. In place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until now, we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school conducted twice a year here at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. The Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult homesteading, along with the business school. All of these schools are available on compact disc. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this concept of, can everybody be right? I mean, after all, if I take one position and you take the opposite position, can we both be right? If my position is that the world is flat and your position is the world that's round, could we both be right? Now, the world could be egg-shaped or it could have some other kind of shape. There could be some third or fourth answer. That's my conclusion to that riddle. But the answer is we both can't take opposite positions and be correct. And yet we find that throughout the world, whether it's in politics, religion, economics, or whatever we're talking about, people have opposite views, and we don't like to get controversial, do we? I mean, after all, that's confrontational, and that's not very pleasant. So we kind of talk behind people's back, and I've mentioned this fellow Tim LaHaye. He has written 14 books. They've sold 80 million copies, called Left Behind, The Rapture Story. I don't subscribe to that, but evidently he does. So a young fella by the name of Desserano, D-E-S-E-R-A-N-O, David Desserano, Desserano, maybe it is, wrote a master's thesis called Information Control for Social Manipulation. So we've been analyzing this concept of, can everybody be right? And if they're not, how come so many of us are dead wrong? And I must be one of these dead wrong guys. And so if I'm one of the dead wrong guys, I've made these terrible mistakes and come up with these asinine backward beliefs that little Georgie Gordon has here. How did I come to believe these lies? Well, fear is a powerful means for establishing social control over a population, and the negative effects of media on its consumers are doing just that. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear are the five motivators of human nature. Well, at least that's what Vance Packard said. He was one of these advertising moguls, wrote a book called The Hidden Persuaders Pack in the 1950s. I've read a lot of those types of books, you know, sales books and salesmanship and body language and body English. And, you know, this guy doesn't mean what he says, and you can tell that by his body's posture. You know, things like that. Well, this young fella goes on to tell us a little bit more in this story of the government, media, the institutions like the universities. How do they control? How do they How do they make you and I believe the things that we believe about Ford Motor Cars, or about George Bush or John Kerry, or about things like evolutionary philosophy? You know, we have these beliefs. How did we get these beliefs? Who sold them to us? Well, furthermore, psychiatrist Robert Coles writes that children in some parts of America are more frightened about the world than children that live in Lebanon or North Ireland. This may well have to do with the fact that some of the most violent programming on TV are cartoons aimed at the very young children. The potential consequences of this are staggering, because a generation brought up to fear the world may be willing to do unhealthy things in order to protect themselves from things that aren't there, such as a readiness to sacrifice their basic civil liberties for a false sense of security. So I mentioned that last time. I said, well, gosh, could that be the Patriot Act? Are we Americans now ready to give up our civil liberties? Our government says we got these terrible terrorists running around the world, and they're threatening us, and so we should bend over and let somebody look up our butts at the airports to see if we've got explosives, whether we're Middle Eastern males or not. I thought that was kind of peculiar, so I quit flying. That's my response. Well, at the forefront of White House thinking is the global command and direction of the world economy through information control. While World War II was still ongoing, U.S. leadership recognized the centrality of information control for gaining world advantage. So well before most of the world could do very much about it, U.S. groups, private and governmental, were actively promoting information and cultural primacy on all continents. U.S. films and television programs are today the primary fare of national systems in most countries. News programs, especially CNN, offer U.S. perspective, sometimes the only perspective provided to world audiences. U.S. recorded music, theme parks, and advertising now comprise a major part of the world's cultural environment. And what is of special interest here, however, is the skillful combination of information, instrumentation with philosophic principle. It's a mix that fuels the push toward concentrated cultural power. Not the laws of chance, but strategic planning, rarely identified as such, underlies this development. It has succeeded well beyond the initial expectations of its formulators. Now, on average, individuals in industrialized nations spend 3 hours a day watching television, roughly half of their leisure time. Only to work and sleep is more time devoted. At this rate, someone who lives to be 75 years old would spend more than 9 years of their lives just watching television. So why do we watch so much television? In studies, subjects claimed that television was a means of relaxation, as confirmed by the electroencephalograph, the EEG readings of brain waves, skin resistance, and heart rates of subjects while watching television. However, even though relaxation is associated with TV by the viewers, research has shown that passivity and a lowered level of alertness also correlates to TV viewing. Furthermore, once the television is turned off, the sense of relaxation dissipates quickly, and the passivity and the lowered alertness remains for a considerable period of time after the television has been turned off. So within moments of sitting or lying down and pushing the power button, viewers report feeling more relaxed. Because the relaxation occurs quickly, people are conditioned to associate viewing TV with rest and lack of tension. The association is positively reinforced because viewers remain relaxed throughout the viewing period, and it is negatively reinforced by way of the stress and dysphoric rumination that occurs once the screen goes black again. Now, part of the human attraction to television has to do with our biologic orienting response, which was first described by Ivan Pavlov in 1927. The orienting response is our instinctive visual or auditory reaction to any sudden or novel stimulus. It's part of our evolutionary heritage, we're led to believe, a built-in sensitivity to movement and potential predatory threats. Typical orienting reactions include dilation of the blood vessels to the brain, slowing of the heart, and constriction of blood vessels to major muscle groups. So our brains focus their attention or its attention on gathering more information while the rest of our bodies lie quiet. In 1986, Byron Reeves of Stanford University, Esther Thorson of the University of Missouri, and their colleagues began to study whether the simple formal features of television, cuts, edits, zooms, pans, sudden noises, whether they activate the orienting response, thereby keeping attention on the screen. Well, by watching how brain waves were affected by formal features, the researchers concluded that these stylistic tricks can indeed trigger involuntary responses and then derive their attentional value through the evolutionary significance of detecting movement. It isn't form, not the content of television, that is unique. Annie Lang's research team at Indiana University has shown that heart rate decreases for 4 to 6 seconds after an orienting stimulus. In ads, action sequences, and music videos, formal features frequently come at a rate of 1 per second, thus activating the orienting response continuously. Oh, I gotta stop here and make a comment. You ever watch TV and notice how numbing it becomes to watch the Dodge ad? And it comes about 1 a second, and they show you a different view of this Dodge every second. Did you think that that was an accident? No, sir. They're doing that on purpose. They're doing that to control your responses, to control your buy signs. They want to make you buy that car. Now, of course, not everybody's going to go out and buy that Dodge car, because Ford and General Motors do the same things, don't they? And what it shows us is that these advertisers know how to control us mentally. Not just one or two of them, all of them. And so they're all competing, and so we're constantly being bombarded. Our minds are constantly being bombarded and worked and manipulated and controlled. Remember, only 0.5% of us are taught to think. 0.5% of Americans are actually taught to think. 5.5% are taught partially to think. And the rest of us are just simply controlled by the mass media. We're manipulated like puppets. How do I know that? Well, that's what the psychologists tell us, and all the people with the letters after their names. They're spending all of their time and hundreds of millions of dollars on Madison Avenue and making all of these ads. We do this when we're voting for president. Nobody asks questions like, gee, is expanding the economy from 9 to 13 and a half trillion dollars a good policy? I never heard anybody talk about the expansion of the monetary system or the money supply as being good public policy, did you? I heard sound bites. George Bush, in his stereotyped canned presentations, would tell us the same things over and over again, that democracy in Iraq was necessary and imperative for the good of Iraq and the defeat of terrorism. I got to thinking about this terrorism. If you took all of the people killed by all of the terrorists from 1980 to today, it doesn't amount to 10,000 people. God killed 150,000 people in just a few minutes in the Indian Ocean with one tidal wave. The terrorists aren't a big threat to us. We're not passing Patriot Acts and anti-gravitation bills and putting in big public works projects to build seawalls around the world's coastlines now, are we? To protect us from tidal waves, we recognize that tidal waves are a possibility. Tidal waves can kill people, and they do. But it's one of those things you have to learn to live with. We haven't learned that about terrorism. And that's because our minds have been conditioned to fear terrorists beyond all reason, logic, or common sense. Your chances of getting killed by a terrorist in Iraq are less than getting killed in an automobile. And that's in Iraq, where they're actually out there killing people every day. The number of people that the terrorists are killing every day compared to the number of people that get killed just in ordinary traffic accidents, just to use that as an illustration, isn't as big a threat as we have been led to believe that it is. But we believe that terrorism is such a threat that we have accepted a $37 billion a year Homeland Security Act, for crying out loud. $37 billion a year to have some klutz look up our butt in the airport. I don't need to spend that kind of money to have somebody play proctologist on me. Well, he goes on to say that in August of 1999, the U.S. Army signed a 5-year, $45 million deal with the University of Southern California. They were chosen because of its close proximity to Hollywood to have the school's movies, special effects, and other technology experts help with troop training, including battle scenarios, virtual reality combat, and large-scale simulations, creating settings similar to Operation Desert Storm. This partnership is known as the Institute for Creative Technologies. The digital world and the world of virtual reality is going to be part of the embrace of this new great cooperative venture, said Jack Valenti of the Motion Picture Association of America. However, according to James Derderian, professor of international relations at Brown University, he said, what we're witnessing here today is perhaps not only the announcement of a new sort of technological center, but it is now the creation of a new military-industrial media entertainment complex. Well, in October of 1999, the CIA held a lavish gala film premiere for a movie called In the Company of Spies, the first spy thriller ever to bear the CIA stamp of approval. It starred Tom Berenger and Ron Silver, directed by Tim Matheson, Otter from Animal House, written by Roger Towne, who wrote the screenplay for The Natural. and then produced by David Madden and Robert W. Court, who is himself a former CIA official. It was made directly for Showtime, a subsidiary of AOL Time Warner, the world's largest media corporation, in 2001. Three new TV series, The Agency, Alias, and 24, and seven films, including Bad Company and The Bourne Identity and The Sum of All Fears, were made with the CIA's approval. And then there are the Hollywood filmmakers and the Pentagon. They've gone a long way, and they now have a long history of cooperation. The Pentagon, you see, sees the film industry as an important part of public relations. And according to a recently released memo, it said that military depictions have become more of a commercial for us, which explains the Air Force's eagerness to be a part of the short-lived 2002 CBS reality series American Fighter Pilots, which followed three men as they trained to fly F-15s. Its executive producers were Tony Scott, director of Top Gun, and his brother, Ridley Scott, director of Black Hawk Down. Now, due to the enormous expense of military equipment, it makes financial sense for filmmakers to get military cooperation. However, this often entails the altering of scripts to fit the needs and the desires of the Pentagon. For instance, the military and the government personnel are to be depicted in more positive and in more heroic ways. American ideologies are reinforced and they are never criticized. For example, in the movie GoldenEye, 1995, the original script had a U.S. Navy admiral betraying state secrets. But this was changed to make the traitor a member of the French Navy. And despite having made changes to characters in Independence Day, put out in 1996, the Department of Defense refused help because the military appears impotent and or inept. All advances in stopping aliens are the result of actions by civilians. Other films that received assistance from the Pentagon are Air Force One, 1997, A Few Good Men, 1992, Armageddon, 1998, The Hunt for Red October, 1990, Pearl Harbor, 2001, Patriot Games, 1992, Wind Talkers, 2002, Hamburger Hill, 1987, The American President, 1995, Behind Enemy Lines in 2001, Apollo 13 in 1995, and Tomorrow Never Dies, 1997. But here are some films that were denied assistance, and they included Apocalypse Now, 1979, Catch-22, 1970, Doctor Strangelove, 1964, Full Metal Jacket, 1987, The Last Detail, 1973, Lone Star, 1996, Mars Attacks, 1996. You see, boys and girls, if we've got something to sell, and I've mentioned this to you before, let's take a look at the war and the war coverage going on in Iraq. Have you ever noticed? Pay attention. Just go in and watch the news and notice that the reports that come out of Iraq are 100% negative. 100% negative. There are no reports coming out of Iraq that talk about the heroism of American soldiers or the sacrifices being made. Every night, Dan Rather, on the 6 o'clock news, takes one person and gives a short autobiographic description of a man who has just been killed, an American soldier who has been killed in Iraq. They tell about his wife and his children and his hopes and his dreams and how they will never be realized because now Sergeant Jones has been killed. Now, what's the purpose for putting out these 100% negative reports from Iraq? Isn't it to turn you against the war in Iraq? And that's precisely what has been accomplished. Now, don't think for a minute that the United States government doesn't have a motive or a purpose in what it's doing. The manipulation of our feelings, like the manipulation by watching an advertisement for a Dodge car, is carefully choreographed to pull our strings. Hey, and it works. It works like a shot. Works on all of us. All of us have emotions. All of us have ideas and beliefs. And when government wants to change your belief or they want to influence you, just take a look at evolutionary philosophy. I did a series on evolution, taken right out of National Geographic magazine. And I said, well, let's analyze it. Think about it. Same thing is true here. What we're trying to analyze here is a phenomenon. You got 70 million people who believe in the rapture. But the word rapture does not appear in the Bible. Doesn't occur there, not once. That should be our first clue that this is not a biblical, it's not a scriptural doctrine, idea. Didn't come from God. If it did, then we should be able to see rapture. We should be able to find the rapture story, the rapture theory in the Bible. I mean, after all, we can look in the Bible and we can see the Passover. Go to Exodus chapter 12. The whole chapter deals with the Passover. Three times in the chapter it says that this law, this Passover law, is to be observed forever. Forever. Christmas hasn't even been observed forever. Christmas was only popularized by Queen Victoria beginning in 1849. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert first popularized Christmas in 1849 in the modern era. Did you think that we had a Christmas tree on the White House lawn in Abraham Lincoln's day, or George Washington? Or come on, guys, let's start thinking. When do these things evolve? When do they come about? Now, to give you an idea about the Passover is mentioned in Exodus 12. It's mentioned in the Bible 76 times. In Luke chapter 22, verses 7 through 13, it's just one example. Jesus tells his disciples to go make ready, to get ready for the Passover. We're about to go observe the Passover. Do Christians practice the Passover today? Now, the Passover is a biblical doctrine. The Passover is mentioned many times in the Bible, 76 times. The rapture is not a biblical doctrine. It's never talked about in the Bible. It's a theory that came along in 1812. The word rapture doesn't appear in the Bible, and yet one out of every four Americans believe in the rapture. Now, somehow or another, that doesn't make any sense. Well, at least not to my simple mind. It would seem like to me that if we were going to do something that was scriptural, if we were concerned about following the Bible, that we would practice the Passover. But I'm told that that's Jewish. The Bible doesn't say that the Passover is Jewish. Before the word Jew ever appears in the Bible, back in Moses' time, the whole 12 tribes of Israel, not just the tribe of Judah, but the tribe of Simeon and Levi and all of the tribes were practicing the Passover all at the same time in Egypt, for crying out loud. Jesus in the New Testament is practicing the Passover. The Apostle Paul talks about the Passover in 1 Corinthians. But you don't find Christians practicing the Passover. You find Christians practicing Easter, the rapture, Christmas. But if you look in the Bible, Jeremiah 10, 1 through 6 describes the Christmas tree, calls it a pagan practice, and tells us not to do that. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32, we're told not to add to this law and not to take away from it. We're not to add holy days, and we're not to take holy days away. But we've got Christmas, Easter, and New Year's that we've added, and we've got the Passover, the days of unleavened bread, and the Feast of Tabernacles, and the last great day, and the Day of Atonement, and we don't practice those. Now, why is that? Can you figure that out? Can you tell me? Well, I'll leave that up to you. Going on, he says, now on February the 19th, 2002, the New York Times reported that the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence, it's called the OSI, was developing plans to provide news items, possibly even false news items, to foreign media organizations in an effort to influence public sentiment and public opinion and policymakers in both friendly and unfriendly countries. My God, do you mean that they're in the Pentagon? Now get this. Let me cover this again. On February 19th, 2002, the New York Times reported that the Pentagon has an office of strategic influence called the OSI, and that office was developing plans to provide news items, possibly even false news items, to foreign media organizations in an effort to influence public sentiment and policymakers in both friendly and unfriendly countries. Do you mean our Pentagon is putting out news articles which are false? Some are true, some are false, for the purposes of influencing public opinion and policymakers in those countries. Well, then, isn't that for the purposes of deceiving people into believing things that aren't true? I mean, that's just government policy, to make you believe something that isn't true. It goes on. It gets better. The OSI was created just after 9/11 to publicize the U.S. government's perspective in Islamic countries and to generate support for the U.S. war on terror. The latest announcement raises grave concerns that far from being an honest effort to explain U.S. policy, the OSI may be a profoundly undemocratic program devoted to spreading disinformation and misleading the public both at home and abroad. The government is barred by law from propagandizing within the United States, but the OSI's new plan will likely lead to disinformation planted in foreign news reports and then being picked up by U.S. news outlets. Did you get that? Well, you know, that isn't something that's just brand new, that just came into existence, you know, in the last couple of 3 years. That's a plan that's been going on for a long time. Hang on, we'll come back and talk to that subject here in just a minute. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember the website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about being left behind, the rapture story. Remember, the rapture now doesn't appear in the Bible. Check me out. Go pick up a concordance and look up the word rapture. See if you can find it anywhere. While you're at it, look up the word Passover. Now, you probably believe in the rapture, but you don't believe in the Passover. But the Passover is mentioned 76 times in the Bible. Jesus practiced the Passover. He didn't practice the rapture even once, never even mentioned the rapture even once. Never taught about it. None of the disciples did. You got 70 million people that believe in the rapture, and nobody believes in the Passover. Now, can you explain that? Now, that takes pretty good propagandizing, doesn't it? Especially for people that read the Bible and go to church, wouldn't you think? Now, we're talking about deception. Would the United States government deliberately try to deceive somebody? Or would they try to deceive groups of people? Would the U.S. government or the Defense Department or the Pentagon or anybody else go so far as to spread lies for the express purpose of influencing you to believe something one way or the other, you or somebody else? Well, that's what they're reporting in the New York Times. Now, have you ever heard the name Jane Aker, A-K-R-E, or Steve Wilson? Well, Jane Aker and Steve Wilson used to work for WTVT Fox 13 down in Florida, and they were both fired. They did a news story on the milk industry down there, and they uncovered some skullduggery going on. Well, the television station receives advertising from the milk industry, and so they don't want to say anything negative about milk. And so these two reporters were ordered to lie in their report, and they refused to do that, and so they got fired. Well, for what is believed to be the first time ever, two television journalists have challenged the broadcast license of a television station on grounds that it deliberately broadcast false and distorted news reports. Veteran reporters Jane Aker and Steve Wilson filed a petition Monday against WTVT Fox 13 in Tampa, Florida, a unit of Rupert Murdoch's Fox television empire. The formal petition to deny the station's pending license renewal presents the Federal Communications Commission with 98 pages of what these journalists say is clear and convincing support for the claim that the licensee is not operating in the public interest and lacks the good character to do so. The challenge stems from what the reporters say was a year-long experience inside the station where they resisted Fox managers who repeatedly ordered them to distort a series of news reports about the secret use of an artificial hormone injected into dairy cattle throughout Florida and beyond. Now, the claim also cites another case of alleged deliberate distortion at the Fox-owned television station in Kansas City, WDAF Fox Channel 4. The journalists also charged that WTVT has violated federal rules with regard to keeping on file viewer complaints and comments. The reporters say not one communication regarding the dispute over the hormone story was found in the files, even though there were several examples of letters which should have been there. There are no greater supporters of the First Amendment than Steve and I, Aker said, but the First Amendment is certainly not a license to lie, and no broadcaster should be allowed to put its own financial interests ahead of the public interest. The public interest is, by law, the primary obligation of every broadcaster who uses our public airwaves to make their corporate fortune, especially when broadcasting the news. The FCC itself has clearly said rigging or slanting the news is a most heinous act against the public interest, and indeed there is no act more harmful to the public's ability to handle its affairs. And who can disagree, Wilson added. The reporters charge station executives demanded the reports be falsified and slanted to avoid a threatened lawsuit by the hormone maker Monsanto, as well as potential loss of advertising from dairymen and others who objected to the reports. Though Fox officials never pointed to a single inaccuracy in the proposed broadcasts, they nonetheless fired the two after the reporters refused to yield to management threats of dismissal. The two also refused what they characterized as a six-figure offer of hush money from station managers who wanted them to leave and forever keep quiet about the issue. So they tried to bribe these two, and these two journalists said, no, we don't want the bribe money. We want to tell the truth. In 1998, the two filed a civil court lawsuit seeking employee protections under the State Whistleblower Act that resulted in a $425,000 jury award to Aker. That verdict was then overturned in 2003 when an appeals court accepted Fox's defense that since it is not technically against any law, rule, or regulation for a broadcaster to distort the news, the journalists were never entitled to the employee protections as whistleblowers in the first place. Now, did you get that? Now, we're trying to figure out why it is that we believe the things that we believe. Whether you believe in the rapture, or you believe in evolution, or you believe in George Bush, you didn't arrive at those beliefs for no good reason. You came to those conclusions based upon information that came into your computer, came into your mind, just like I did. And so I have rejected the rapture theory, and Tim LaHaye says, well, Gordon, too bad for you. Put your head between your knees and kiss your ass goodbye because you're going to hell. I just somehow don't believe that part of the story either. I think that there is a more logical conclusion. I really just don't think that the God of the Bible, the Creator, I'm not talking about the God of Christians and the God of Muslims and the God of Zeus and Thor and all these gods out here. I recognize that people have a lot of gods, a lot of beliefs, but I just don't think that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has that in mind. That's not what I'm reading. That isn't what my computer tells me after I read the information. That's why I thought I'd bring it to your attention. Now, here we see the courts. They come in, you know, these two reporters come into court and they say, well, listen, we were fired because we told the truth about Monsanto and this growth hormone. And the station, for their part, says, well, we're concerned about being sued by Monsanto and we're concerned about losing advertising revenue from the dairy industry. So we want to lie about this story. We don't want to put this story on. So the two reporters sue. They say, well, we're whistleblowers. And the court says, well, wait a minute. There's no law. There's no law against lying in the news or telling a falsehood. Now, how do you like that? Now, that's quite a little story, wouldn't you say? And that goes on here in America. Do you think that that influences people? Does that influence people's thinking? Now, for its part, Fox Network has always denied that it ever ordered deliberate distortions. The jury found the reports at the heart of the dispute were false, distorted, or slanted, while the appellate court ruled that reversing the jury called the journalist suit without merit from its inception. That finding was based solely upon the court's finding on the threshold issue that the whistleblower law did not apply in this particular case. No court has ever disputed the jury's conclusions about the news reports themselves. Now think about that for a minute. Here you are. You're sitting on the jury. These people, these two journalists, have sued their employer, Fox News. And they said, they told us they wanted us to lie about this report concerning the safety of milk, BHT, Monsanto, and we refused. They fired us for that. If you were sitting on the jury, how would you rule? What would be your conclusion? You know, it would seem like to me, if I was sitting on the jury, I would rule in favor of the two journalists also, just in the interest of truth. Notice that the story tells us plainly that the radio station, the TV station, never argued that there was anything false in the report. They said, we don't want to air this true story because it's going to offend Monsanto, it's going to offend the dairymen. Now, I don't know whether you've read any stories about genetically modified foods or about this BHT that they put into the cows to make the cows give more milk, but don't you think that you should be informed on both sides of the issue so that you can make a determination? Do you think that you could make a proper determination in your own self-interest based upon lies that are fed to you by the dairymen or by Monsanto? Or, for that matter, lies that are fed to you by the two journalists? Don't you think that you should have the truth, and that the truth should be the paramount decider of what should be aired on radio and television? Well, we here at the Law or an Editorial Review believe that the truth is paramount in our reporting, and that's why from time to time I point out to you, the listening audience, that the Law or an Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. So we come on the air and we say, well, we want to tell you these facts. We want to give you this information. The sources of the information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. What would you think if I came on the air and I said, now, I'm reporting this story to you, but I'm lying to you because I don't want to offend the dairy industry. I don't want to offend the Republican Party. I don't want to offend 70 million evangelicals. I don't want to offend Catholics. I don't want to offend Jews. I don't want to offend Masons. Have you noticed that on this program, we cover a pretty wide variety of factual events that transpire? Sometimes it's absolutely offensive to Jews, Masons, Catholics, Protestants, Muslims. We offend everybody. Do you know that the truth offends everybody? That's just where reality is located. So when you go to church, have you ever noticed that your preacher never offends you? He doesn't offend anybody, does he? Does he ever tell the truth? If I were to tell you the truth about genetically modified foods, I'm going to offend Monsanto and a lot of people that make their living off of GM foods. But just because you make your living off of GM foods, does that make genetically modified foods good for human consumption? Does it make it good for the environment? Just because you're a soldier in the Army, does that mean that everything that the Pentagon does, everything that your government does, is correct, or that it's right, or that it's moral, or it's righteous? Isn't that what free speech and debate is all about? Now, this brings us up to the subject of education versus indoctrination. I've brought this up, mentioned it a time or two, that education is the process by which we bring information to you, and you sort through the information, and then you make a decision based upon your own mental processes. That's assuming that you've been trained to think, or perhaps you've been trained to partially think. Or maybe you're one of the masses that's just looking around saying, you know, maybe it's time that I started thinking. Instead of just accepting what Dan Rather tells me, maybe I ought to ask questions. Is it really true because Dan Rather and CBS tells me it's true? Or is it true because I've looked it up and at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses I've established the matter? Because that's what we try to do here at the Law Hour. The sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. What if I'm wrong? What if I'm delivering information that's incorrect? What if these rapture people are correct and those of us that don't believe in this rapture are incorrect? You ever stop to think of that? Well, then, shouldn't you check up on me and find out whether or not I'm telling you the truth? Maybe you had better take the bull by the horns and not believe what I'm telling you just because I'm telling it. Kind of reminds me of, I'm not satisfied with the United States of America as my guardian. I'm looking for a new guardian. We tend to believe what people tell us. Now, the other night I was watching Frontline, and they had a story on there. I believe it was Frontline. It was a story about Woodrow Wilson. I've read quite a bit about Woodrow. Pretty nice guy, and they had a lot of neat insights concerning Woodrow Wilson, a very positive story about Woodrow Wilson. It was a media story about an ex-president. They didn't say anything that was derogatory about him, and when they talked about him, they said, well, he failed with the League of Nations because of Henry Cabot Lodge and because of his personality, because of his Calvinist attitudes. Well, gee, could it have been his communist or socialist leanings that maybe the American people weren't quite ready for at that time? Because today, Americans accept communism because they've been taught and trained. And oftentimes, I will go to an audience, and when I'm speaking to an audience, I'll ask the question, are you a practicing communist? Think about that for a minute. Are you a practicing communist? Nobody wants to admit that they're a practicing communist. Not in America. At least I haven't found any. And so, if I say, well, how many in the audience are practicing communists? Nobody raises their hands, except me. I'm up on the stage, and I'll raise my hand and say, well, I used to be a practicing communist. You see, I used to practice. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you people out here in the audience, except for four or five states in the union, I'll ask, do you pay an income tax here in your state? Do you have a state income tax? And except for five states, everybody will raise their hands and they'll say, well, yeah, we have a state income tax. And, well, that's the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. Do you have a public school system here in your state? And most people will say, yeah, we've got a public school system. Well, did you attend the public school system in your state? Yes. People will say, yes, I attended public school here. And do you have children? Yes. And do they attend public school? Yeah, they do. I said, well, did you know that's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto? And that under our Constitution, we have no public school system provided for, and we have no income tax provided for. Did you know that those are two planks of the Communist Manifesto that were added after our Constitution was adopted? Now, you know, you knew that, didn't you? I'm not telling you something that you didn't know and have never heard before. But have you ever admitted to yourself that you're a practicing communist? Let's try the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. It calls for a central bank. Do we have a central bank in the United States? Yes, it's called the Federal Reserve System. And do you have a checking account? Yes, well, most people would say yes, a savings account. And do you do business at the bank and have a mortgage on your house and maybe three credit cards in your pocket? And everybody will say, well, yes, of course, that's natural and that's normal. Well, that's the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. So here's the second plank, the income tax, the tenth plank, public school, the fifth plank, a central bank, and you're practicing one-third of the communist program. And it's pretty normal and pretty natural, isn't it? Now, if I said, do you believe in communism? Do you believe that communism as a political, economic, religious, or philosophical program is good for you and good for America? Do you subscribe to communism? Almost everybody will say, well, no, God, no, I don't subscribe to communism at all. Did you know the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the establishment of a national industrial army? You've probably heard that. Did you know that the social security system is a national industrial army and that you're a part of it if you have a social security account? Now, there's 4 out of 10. Now, you see, here you are practicing four planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, that's a third. You're a one-third communist. Let's see if we can make turn you into a 50% communist. Do you have a property tax in your state? Most people say, well, yes. And do you own property? Well, of course. And do you pay the property tax? Yes. Do you know that the property tax calls for, or that the first plank to the manifesto calls for, the abrogation or the abolition of all right to property and land? And do you subscribe to that? Did you know that in the early days in America, we did not have property tax? Now, you know, people today will practice these planks to the Communist Manifesto. They will protest solemnly that they are not communists, don't believe in communism. Well, then how do you explain people practicing all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in modern America today? I mean, I just recited 4 or 5 of them off the top of my head. Now, you know, we all practice this. There was a time in America when we didn't. When did Americans come to believe that public school was good for America and good for Americans? It's not in our Constitution. So the beliefs that we come up with, even when we're confronted with the truth, even when two reporters come into to the station with a news story, they can't put the story on the air. Do you know what would happen to me if I came on the air with a story like this on my local TV stations? I would be fired because I'm offending all of you evangelicals out there. I'm offending Catholics. I'm offending so many people. Many of you people aren't offended anymore because you've already turned the radio off. You're not going to listen to this guy ridicule and make fun of you. But what was it that made you believe in the rapture to start with? What was it that made you believe in Social Security, or the income tax, or the Federal Reserve System, or the abolition of all right to property and land, or public school? Where did you get these ideas and beliefs? Did you get them from the public schools? Did you get them from your church? Did you get this belief in the rapture from the Bible, or did you get it from someplace else? Isn't it about time we started looking at where are we getting these beliefs? Who is it that's influencing us? Is it the Justice Department? Is it the State Department? Is it the Republicans or the Democrats? Why did we vote for the guy that we voted for in the last election? Is it because he represents the values and the beliefs that we have? Or is it that we're letting them do our thinking for us? Is that what's happening? Somebody else is doing our thinking for us. Well, I'm going to have to cut it off right about here. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station, of course, to take this up and continue with the story of Left Behind, the rapture story. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is brought to you by the Gordon Law School. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's a signal that says my time is up. I'm going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.